This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to Talk Louisiana on WWNO New Orleans and WRKF Baton Rouge Friday Politics. Thank you for joining us on Good Friday. 877-217-5757 is your number, 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. Signature support for our program is from the office of East Baton Rouge Parish Mayor Sharon Weston Broom's office. And the show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. Two people joining us in studio on Good Friday are seasoned politicos in Louisiana, both involved in notable governor's races. In 1995, Roy Fletcher led Mike Foster to victory. Foster came from nowhere. He was an unknown state senator from Franklin, and he beat Buddy Romer and Mary Landrieu and Cleo Fields and Phil Price and Melinda Schwegman. It was quite a race in 95. And now, in 2015, 20 years later, Mary Patricia Ray, who's with us, guided John Bell Edwards to victory in a field that included David Bitter and Jay Darden and Scott Angel, who was represented by Roy Fletcher. So they know the lay of the land, and of course we have a new sheriff in town. Governor Jeff Landry is at the Capitol. We're in our third session already, and there is a call from him for legislative leaders to assemble for a constitutional convention, which would go well into July. And this is something that is being weighed at the Capitol. It would convene delegates in late May, as in a couple of months from now, to write a totally new constitution to replace the one that's been in place for a half century. Your thoughts, again, if you'd like to join the conversation, 877-217-5757. And Governor Landry wants to have lawmakers to convene as delegates and also for 27 appointees from his office to be included in the Constitutional Convention. Where is this going, Mary Patricia Ray? What are your thoughts about whether this is pliable?
It's going to require 2/3 vote of the legislature to pass an authorizing piece of legislation. And right now we have one on the table that basically, for your listeners who know anything about Marie Kondo and decluttering, it prescribes the process to declutter the current constitution by making a keep pile, a throwaway pile, and a donate to a statute pile. However, I think we all know that our legislators will likely try to do a little more than that in both the legislation and in the convention if there is one. But right now, I think the governor's biggest challenge is the Senate. The Senate and their 39 members don't seem poised to agree to what's in the bill right now, including the timing of this convention. And from where I sit, and then I'm going to let our real resident expert on many constitutional conventions that have happened since he's been working in politics, including 1992, which a lot of people don't really remember. I think we probably don't need a constitutional convention. And the reason I say that is having helped to work on the book about CC 73 called The Last Constitution by Jeremy Alford. It's the same fights over and over again. And we have those same fights even after we pass a new constitution. So things like governing our university systems, breakaway school districts, it doesn't really matter what you put in the constitution. People fight about those same things afterwards anyways.
51 years since the 73 Constitutional Convention. Roy Fletcher was a young lad of 22 then, but you remember it, don't you?
Very well. Very well.
That was Edwin Edwards' crowning achievement.
One of them, and E.L. Bubba Henry's. I consider that was a real victory for Bubba Henry. And I do think, though, that if you just look at it, the first thing that's quite obvious is we're going to have a constitutional convention with a legislature. That's a little problematic, in my opinion. I mean, I know there's a certain desire for continuity but the fact is that, I mean, our model and the model of many states, our nation, is that you sort of have your own delegates elected and you go
elected, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody that is sort of pushing outside of the governor, that's pushing for this constitutional convention, wants an election of delegates. That's just my gut, because I don't think they would be real happy with what they got Or at least they fear that anyway.
Well, they've combined different past processes, right? So in 73, all the delegates were elected, and the convention, of course, took basically years to complete. Yeah. In this process, in 92, mm-hmm. they had the legislature sit.
That's right.
Without any appointees of the governor, right? There were appointees of the governor in 73. So this process is trying to marry those two things together, and it's created some really awkward situations because you've got a bicameral legislature, but you're adding a third cameral, essentially, but not really. You're making it all one again. And so it's very awkward.
It's very awkward. And I mean, I think people are, at some point, are going to go, wait a minute, I don't like the way this is. I don't want the legislature deciding this constitution, given that it's a constitution that's going to have a profound impact on where we do business.
And lawmakers and delegates to constitutional conventions have different motives.
Absolutely.
Lawmakers represent a constituency of their voters.
That's right.
And they may at times take positions they don't even agree with because they're representing their voters.
And they have to get reelected.
Correct.
Yes.
Where a constitutional convention is, it's more like being a judge.
That's right.
You're deciding on the merits of a bill, whether it is appropriate, rather than what is electorally
politically expedient.
Yes.
So, well, and Roy, you know, you've worked on a lot of constitutional amendments over the years that have gone to a vote of the people, and so have I. And I'm sure that your experience is the same as mine, which is, you know, I've passed one constitutional amendment and killed probably six of them at the ballot, and having spent $4 million to pass one and sometimes only $30,000 to kill one, I worry about whether or not this convention can produce something in June or July that can pass on the ballot in November, unless it is very, very minimal.
Well, yes. And I mean, and what we're talking about, I agree with you 100% on that. What we're talking about is what it appears we're talking about is not just simply cosmetic surgery here. We're talking about real stuff. I mean, we're talking about taxation policy, et cetera, et cetera.
Pensions.
Yes. And when you get into people's pocketbooks and you start talking, I think there's a little reluctance to
just say yes.
Hal and Monroe asked why is Jeff Landry doing it now? Well, generally, governors try to strike when the iron is hot, the so-called honeymoon. Why not now if he wants one?
I mean, I don't blame him for doing it this way. Or at least trying to get it done quickly. The problem is that I think in their haste, they change in a process that I just don't. I find to be a little bit concerning to people, and we'll become more so as we get down to
And another listener, Mary Patricia Ray, says this wasn't discussed a lot in the campaign. Well, not much was discussed.
I would actually disagree. And not to be argumentative with the listener, but I think maybe more inside the rails, it was very clear that many of major donors to Governor Jeff Landry were very much in favor of a constitutional convention and have been for some time. There was an attempt in 2019 to do this, and it's basically the same folks leading that effort.
We know who they are.
Yeah, well, and we know what their priorities are.
Yeah, we know exactly what their priorities
are. And here's listener Shannon in New Orleans, and this is an observation that is quite cogent. I think it was in his first term that, remember, Buddy Romer wanted a single board of higher education.
That's correct.
And that was a sweeping change.
That was a huge change.
And, of course, that was 36 years ago, and we still don't have a single board being missed by one vote.
Yes, that's exactly right. He did.
Well, in the transcripts of the 73 convention, there are weeks and weeks of time taken up over consolidating the systems, and it didn't happen. And the fact that it didn't happen is maybe the only reason that that and a homestead exemption are the only reason that that convention even passed a vote of the people, that constitution even exists today.
There was eventually an effort to get to some sort of one board thing. That was Mike Foster who did that, but it wasn't. It didn't end up being one board, but it ended up being sort of a super board in the process.
Well, and it has a lot of racial issues. You know, you can't come in and say we're going to combine HBCUs with the LSU system, with the UL system, and expect that there's not a lot of people who have concerns about what that means for the future of HBCUs and UL, whether that's in 2024 or in 1973.
Well, Jeff Landry has been an active man in his first, not even 100
I'm tired.
Days.
And I hope if anyone in his office is listening, I'm very tired. We've had two special sessions, a regular session, and now a convention.
Well,
we're all ready for a vacation.
And there were 23 days in January, 29 in February. That's 52, and now we're at 29. So he's at day 81 of his tenure. I would say, Roy, that Jeff Landry's a vigorous
I think so. And been pretty damn successful with what he's tried. I mean, he's had a couple of setbacks a little bit.
But for the most part,
he's
playing a good hand, too.
Yes, very good.
He got
very
a head start hand. With winning that primary.
That's right. And we'll be back with more after this. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. And two of our favorite guests, Roy Fletcher and Mary Patricia Ray, are with us. Mary Patricia, I think last time was with us on Ash Wednesday. Now it's Good Friday. So
yep.
She's a good Catholic person.
I'll be at Mass today, Jim.
Jim?
As is Roy.
It's the third. I think this is the third time I've done Good Friday with you in the last 10 years.
Well.
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad.
Good tradition.
Well, tradition. And I like it. I'm not sacred anything.
But Roy is a Republican who represents Democrats on occasion. And Mary Patricia Ray is a Democrat who represents Republicans on occasion. And I remember our friend and Roy's former colleague and, I guess, mentor, Raymond Strother.
Yes.
He got in a lot of hot water back in the day when he was representing Romer.
Oh, my God.
He was a Democrat working for Republicans.
People get upset.
Yeah, in 91, yeah. But, I mean, you see, Raymond made a big point about it. He just went way out there and made a big point about being his staunch, strong, loving Democrat.
Wasn't good for business.
Well, it wasn't good for business.
That's about the time that Ray moved to Montana.
Yes, it was. Yeah,
you know, speaking of mentors, though I have not had the benefit of always being able to have my guests' mentorship because we sometimes have to go against each other in campaigns. He did help write me a letter of recommendation for my American Association of Political Consultants 40 under 40. And I truly believe that the insanely great political consultants that were willing to recommend me for that award is why I got it. And I'm very, very thankful to him.
Well,
I've learned a lot from watching Roy.
And you both have a background in law, too. So that sometimes helps. 877-217-5757.
Keeps me out of jail, Jim.
Okay, so what's the rumor about you representing Cleo Fields?
Well, it's a rumor, but, you know, it probably is a good rumor. You know, look, that's a relationship. That is a young man, when he was, I don't know, 21 years old, we found each other in Pat Screen's campaign for mayor in 84. And we've just been together ever since, and I wouldn't think of it.
In 1984, where you met him?
Yeah. He actually was putting up signs at Southern and doing all the voter registration, all that stuff out there.
He's an amazing force of nature.
He is. Lee Wesley, in fact, introduced him to me and brought him into the campaign.
But I talked with a close supporter and advisor to Garrett Graves the other day, and he said we, talking about him and Garrett, are going to win this court case, and the district's going to be thrown out, and Garrett's going to be reelected to Congress. Mary Patricia Ray, I would say, based on what's happening around the country, that the odds are against that.
Well, you know, I mean, look, I live in Garrett's current district, and likely Senator Fields's new district, and I've been proud of a lot of things that Garrett has done. I've disagreed with some of them, and no bones about it. I mean, I posted from a Cleo Fields fundraiser the other night on my social media, so it's not like I can or would want to run from my support. And I think just hedging bets, it's unlikely to see the district favor Garrett after the court case is finished. It just is. I mean, that's just
given the Alabama court case, the one that they just decided not long ago. I just don't see how I can understand wishful thinking, But
definitely.
But reality says that's a long shot to get this.
Well, to get this. Congressman Graves doing exactly what he should do, right? Like my political consultant hat, as opposed to my constituent hat, is you tell people I'm going to be running. The map's going to be favorable. I need your donation. Like that's what you should be doing.
Well,
right now.
Yeah. Except at some point, the lick log sets in, and. Wait a minute, Garrett, that didn't work out that way. What are you doing
well,
now?
Well, he may sit out, as Cleo did.
Yes.
Cleo just came home.
And that's a fair point, because I think at the press club, Cleo said that they asked him about all that. And he said, look, he's faced with nothing more than I faced 30 years ago.
27.
20, yeah. Whatever, you know the point.
But you were involved in his congressional campaign.
Sure.
When he won.
Yeah.
And then you were involved with Mike Foster.
In 95.
When he lost.
Yeah, and that. I mean, that was a story that, I mean, it was near Christmas. Cleo was thinking about running for governor, and I got an offer, and I called Cleo, and I said, Senator, a congressman, I got this offer to do this governor's race, but I'm going to let you have the veto. If you're running, you tell me. And he said, no, you go ahead and do it. He said, I don't know what I'm going to do. You go ahead and do that. I'll never forget that. That was a very kind to him, and it shows our relationship.
And in defeat, and it was a resounding defeat, but he still got more votes in 1995 in defeat than Jeff Landry received in victory in 2023.
Says a lot about turnout, don't it?
Yeah.
It does, and we have more people and more voters now, too.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
I guess we have more people out.
But for those who say Landry didn't get a mandate, well, people choose not to vote. That's a vote. I say he did get a mandate.
You vote with your feet.
If you didn't like it,
well,
you had
to. Well, winning in a primary, period.
That's strong. Right. And by the way, they had people who spent money against him, too. I mean, so.
A lot of money.
Yeah. Right. Well, up next is Sean Wilson, by the way, in just a bit. Dr. Sean Wilson, who lost to Jeff Landry, and people have said he ran a terrible campaign, but he got 26% of the votes. Now, the people who ran terrible campaigns were Stephen Wagasback and Hunter Lundy, and they spent lots of money. John Schroeder. But Jeff Landry won, and now there are rumors about him. If Donald Trump becomes president of the U.S., does Landry take a spot in his administration, if offered, Roy?
I think he'd make a hell of attorney general. I'm going to just go ahead and say it right now. Well, I think he'd make a great attorney general.
It didn't fare well for another Southerner named Jeff.
I know. You can bring that up.
But he's close to the Trumps, and
yes,
particularly Don Jr.
Yes.
And Mary Patricia Ray.
Well, I mean, I think any governor offered the opportunity to serve in a presidential appointed role is inclined to say yes, regardless of who that president is, especially since I think, I was a young person when Jeff Landry was in Congress and I didn't even live in Louisiana, but it's always struck me that he enjoyed that.
He did.
Much more than being governor, or being attorney general of Louisiana. So
I don't know if he enjoys being governor, but he loved being governor.
I don't know who. I'm just going to say I don't know who would enjoy being governor. It really is a thankless job.
Come on. You got servants and chauffeurs.
I don't know.
Protection.
Jim, I think, though, that I think.
And you got Francis Thompson beating on you all day and long.
All right, okay. Patrick in Innisfail Estate. Patrick, you're on with Roy and Mary Patricia.
Hey, so you guys are talking about the low voter turnout, and I think it was mostly on the Democrat side. Do you think that, especially like in the black community, do you think they're starting to realize the Democrat Party just doesn't serve their interests?
All right. Well, the turnout was low everywhere because it was 35%. It was, if the Democrats had voted more, they would have, the outcome would have been different. And if the Republicans had voted more, Jeff Landry probably would have gotten 70% or 80% of the votes. It was low. People were not galvanized, energized, whatever you want to call it. But the Democrats do, I think, Mary Patricia, you being a Democrat, they do have some issues as far as viability
in
this
state.
What
I would say is I don't think anyone, Democrat or Republican, in this state is really voting because they think a party represents their interests anymore. I think especially in a governor's race, they're voting for the person. And Jeff Landry had a 21-1 financial advantage over all the other Republicans because of his early endorsement by the Republican Party and his ability to take money into that account at $100,000 a pop. Never been done before that early in in a governor's race. So I think what happened is the person who spent money on direct voter outreach with very appealing messages won in a primary, and the people who didn't did not.
Same happened in 2022 with Kennedy.
Yep.
I mean, same kind of scenario. He just had a wad of money he'd built up, but
John Kennedy.
Yeah, but he had, but his whole campaign was built around that direct contact, so on and so forth.
877-217-5757. We'll spend a few more minutes with Mary Patricia Ray and Roy Fletcher, and then we'll hear from Dr. Sean Wilson. He'll comment on the terrible tragedy this week in Baltimore. A bridge came down as Louisiana with 11 bridges across the Mississippi River, for example, and the biggest port system in the world. Are we in jeopardy of a similar calamity if we had the bad break that Baltimore got? We'll talk about that, but we'll spend a bit more time with Mary Patricia and Roy when we return after this time out on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to Talk Louisiana, Friday Politics on WRKF 89.3 Baton Rouge and WWNO 89.9 New Orleans. Your number is 877-217-5757. Few more minutes with seasoned politicos, political consultants who both won long shot bids for governor for their candidates. Roy Fletcher in 1995 with Mike Foster, Mary Patricia Ray in 2015 with John Bell Edwards. Sheba in New Orleans. Sheba, you were on Talk Louisiana.
Hey, everybody. I thought I'd chime in a little bit and talk about a group here in New Orleans. The acronym, VOTE, V-O-T-E. Voice of the Experience. But yeah, you guys are right. The Democrats did not put up a fight in our last election. We're taking it to the streets. We're taking it to the people that, you know, the blue collar people, the people that have the experience of the majority of the people and not just politicians. Because, yeah, we're not happy with those crime bills that passed.
All right, you're breaking up, Sheba, but Mary Patricia, what will it take to get Democrats back in the game? Right now, whatever is being done or not being done isn't working in Louisiana on a statewide basis. Now, in the major cities, those are still largely run by Democrats, but statewide, a different story.
Well, you know, look, I think that what's taken for granted sometimes is that people who do vote in a chronic way, show up every time, are more sophisticated than most people want to acknowledge. And what I mean by that isn't that you have to do a special message necessarily or they're extra smart. I think they know when there's a shot that their candidate is going to win and when there isn't a shot that their candidate is going to win, and that propensity to win really drives propensity to vote more than we have acknowledged. And I'll give you a good example. Sheriff's race in Caddo Parish just finished up. African-American Democrat won. Turnout was great. It was a total outlier compared to state turnout for Democrats. People believed that their candidate would win. They wanted to show up and check the box for their candidate. So you have to build a belief that someone can win. And if you want to improve turnout, that has nothing to do with partisan politics, party goals, party platform, Joe Biden, Donald Trump, or anything that's happening in Washington, D.C.
All right. Sean Wilson is on deck. Roy and Mary Patricia with us for a few more moments. Please be concise. We'll take a few calls if we can. Brandon in Baton Rouge. Brandon, you're on with our guests.
Hey, so basically, I guess the issue that I'm seeing with this new Constitution Convention that they're wanting to do is it seems like they're going to be focused more on business rather than on the environmental issues that we're slowly but surely facing here within the next 6 years and running out of oil in 47 years.
All right. What about the business influence with a highly conservative legislature and a conservative governor? No big surprise, but Roy, your thoughts?
No big surprise, but the point, I would say, you got it half right. Yeah, it's business, but it's really about taxes. It's about who's going to pay.
Our current Constitution has been amended however many times such that the document is about business, tax exemptions, rebates, exclusions. That's what it already is about.
They're really going to pay. Who's going to pay? What they going to do? Are you going to do with a homestead exemption or give tax breaks to corporations? How are we going
to
do this?
Part of the reason it needs to be cleaned up is because it is about business right now, and they're just going to clean it up to kind of hide that a little better.
Final caller for Mary Patricia and Roy, David in Atlanta. David, you're on. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. There's talk at Baton Rouge of deregulating the casualty insurance business. When Ronald Reagan deregulated the SNL, it was a disaster. When George W. Bush deregulated Wall Street, we got the mortgage crisis. Now, the oceans have never been hotter. Scientists are predicting a summer this year hotter than last year. Now, if anybody thinks more competition will bring down insurance rates when Louisiana could likely be the subject of a Category 6 hurricane, well, once the insurance is deregulated, when people open their insurance bills, this is what you're going to hear in Louisiana.
All right. A Category 6?
I'm moving.
God, I hope not, Jim. Jeez.
David used to live in New Orleans. Maybe that's why he's in Atlanta. But we've got an insurance crisis, and we've got an issue with people not moving to our state, and that's a big part of
Florida's got an insurance crisis, too. California's got an insurance crisis, too.
Quite as much as we do, but you're right.
Look, Jim, there are some bills that even this, as you pointed out, Democrat, I think there are some suggestions in the legislature that could prove to be solutions to part of our premium costs on homeowners and other things. A lot of people are focused on this 3-year rule, and I see it on your board out here to do a story on it today. But, bills like the collateral source bill that we have right now that's moving through the legislature, already passed, vetoed by John Bel Edwards. People think it could pass this year, but might be vetoed by Jeff Landry. So I think we have often solutions in search of problems at the legislature. And in the case of insurance, we have a lot of solutions available, but there's two sides that don't want to accept either any of the solutions.
Yep.
Well, thank you both. And we're joined now by Dr. Sean Wilson. We've got 25.9% of the votes in the October 14th primary and did so with a shoestring budget. He lives in Lafayette, educated at UL and at Southern University, but he hails from the great city of New Orleans. And, of course, his 7 years and counting before he ran for governor as Secretary of Transportation, and, of course, he also logged many years as a high-ranking worker in that department. He knows the lay of the land when it comes to safety or lack thereof of bridges and roads, and bridges are under a microscope now. And today, a fine story from David Mitchell in the Advocate Picayune. He notes that on the night of Easter Sunday in 1969, the Taiwanese freighter Union Faith sliced through a crude oil barge, unleashing a towering inferno on the Mississippi River, melting steel on the Greater New Orleans Bridge. 26 crewmen were killed. 25 years later, in 1993, a barge and tugboat on the Industrial Canal in New Orleans took out steel support beams and caused a 145-foot section of the Claiborne Avenue Bridge to collapse, killing a motorist and seriously injuring two others. And in October of 2018, a towboat pushed a large crane barge into the Sunshine Bridge at Donaldsonville, damaging critical support beams. And so we have this issue in Louisiana with the world's largest port system, in which we have heavy traffic and we have bridges that connect the major cities that if they went down, it would be an absolute calamity, catastrophe, and that's where we are. But have we done the best we can, and are we in a reasonably good shape? Dr. Wilson, you have the floor, and it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Welcome back to Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, Jim, to you and your listeners, and thanks for having me. First and foremost, I think we need to be prayerful and thoughtful about the families that were lost of those construction workers. Six people are now dead or presumed dead. Four of them haven't been rescued as of yet or retrieved. And so we can't forget that this is a very dangerous place to work in terms of being on infrastructure projects or in the maritime industry. And as your examples and historic facts always astonishes people, but you are correct. People die in these businesses. The accidents you talked about in Louisiana were really the tip of the iceberg. We have other bridges that have been hit far more times than that, but our fender systems actually work. The nature of being on the Mississippi River, as you know, is pretty volatile, and the pilots who guide those vessels are extremely talented at what they do, but things go wrong. And as in the case of this bridge in Baltimore, there was a mayday, and they didn't have less than any more than 2 minutes to adjust and try to find some corrective action. And Fortunately, those construction workers jumped into their safety culture practices and stopped traffic. It could have been far worse. And I don't know that there's a bridge built that could have withstood the impact of nearly a 1,000-foot vessel that's over 100,000 tons traveling at about 10 miles per hour. Especially if it's a head-on hit, that just would not happen. So long road ahead. I reached out to my counterpart and colleague, Paul, who's the secretary in Maryland. And he's got his hands full right now, but he's very capable, as is that administration. And Secretary Buttigieg and the national folks have already committed $60 million to that project. But this is going to be a major undertaking for Baltimore, as it would be anywhere, Jim.
It'll be a lot more than $60 million, but...
Oh, I suspect this is going to be a $1 billion bridge at the end of the day, and if not more. The reality is right now it's going to be about recovery, because think about the thousands of workers at the port that can no longer do their jobs because you can't get vessels in and out of the port. And so their first order of business is going to be retrieving the vessel out of the channel so they can at least open the channel so that folks can get to work and we can continue to have some normalcy, because you're talking about a payroll in the millions per day. Think about that in terms of the people on those docks, particularly on the eastern coast, in the automobile industry primarily, but other goods and services are going to come to a grinding halt if we can't get vessels in and out of that port. And there's some vessels right now that are trapped that can't get out, that are trying to figure out how to ship their goods, which is why we have to have a multimodal transportation system to put things on rail, on vessel, as well as on the back of trucks. And that bridge was a critical piece while we're working in that recovery effort. It's a pretty dangerous spot to be in from a recovery standpoint, because you're going to have to cut steel underwater. You're going to have to deal with shifting sediment. And you're going to have to figure out how to dislodge the vessel and move it out of the way, and then get into the business of rebuilding that bridge and the adjacent structures. So it's going to be a challenge. Long road ahead.
The barge was, as you noted, how many tons of material were up?
It was estimated to be upwards of 100,000 tons. This was a very large container ship. And if you think about, Jim, this bridge was not built at the time that that ship was built. The ship was newer than the bridge. And so you've got to look at standards. You've got to look at how all of the vessels are getting larger. That's why we dredged the Mississippi River to 50 feet, something that had been talked about for decades.
We'll spend the last quarter hour with Sean Wilson, former Secretary of Transportation, back after this with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to Friday Politics on WWNO New Orleans and WRKF Baton Rouge, the two preeminent public radio stations in Louisiana and two of the finest stations for this kind of programming in the United States or beyond. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails go to talk@talklouisiana.org. Robin Dow producing, and more time with Sean Wilson, the former Secretary of Transportation. He was John Bell Edwards, Secretary of the Department of Transportation and Development for almost the entire 8 years. He resigned to run for governor in the final year, and he ran a strong race, finished second, but second gets you a ticket to the private sector. And a listener asks, Sean Wilson, last time you were on this show, you said you were about to take a position, and you have. What are you doing now?
Great question, Jim. I am a senior vice president with WSP, which is an architecture and engineering firm, second or third largest in the world, depending on the measure you use. We are a global company, and I have a national role that will have me in different parts of the United States talking about infrastructure, working with the industry, and working with other departments of transportation as well as local government. So it's been an exciting month and a half, and I've done a good bit of travel, and I get to use my experience and expertise and lessons as a leader in this business. Very excited to work in this space.
877-217-5757 for Dr. Wilson on Talk Louisiana. Phil in Jefferson, you're on. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, gentlemen. Yes, sir. First of all, I want to thank you for your service and for being an honest broker and and for your all of your work that you've done on behalf of the state, and also for fighting for fairness in taxation and also our infrastructure.
What's your question,
Phil? I apologize. I wish my question is, going forward, what do you think of how we resist our governor who really needs to be impeached?
All right. Well, that's a loaded question and really an inappropriate question for the guy who just lost a race to him. For those who don't like Jeff Landry, and Phil is obviously one of them, you had a chance to make a difference. And we talked about this in the previous segment. Only 35% of the voters, a little more than that, 35.6% showed up, Sean Wilson.
Yeah, it's a disappointing statistic, Jim, and you are correct. We had an opportunity to do that and to resist it, and I think, unfortunately, some people's priorities were focused on different things and not necessarily building the party and building resistance and a structure to do that. You know, regardless of who wins an election, you want your state to do well. And as I said on election night, I wish the new governor the best. I clearly would be doing things differently. I think some of the priorities are quite different than what they would have been had I been in charge and been governor. But that's the impact of having elections. Elections have consequences, and we should all be responsible for that. The most important thing for us to do is to be engaged in the political process. Use this as a building opportunity to bring forth leadership that's going to put people first, because we are the ones who comprise government. And I think that's an important factor. We should be paying attention to the laws that are being passed. There's a lot of things happening very quickly, not addressing priorities perhaps of the masses, but that's the impact and the authority that he's been given as governor. And we just need to support those who are elected and continue to put up a good fight and try to manage good policy in a bipartisan way. And that's an important factor for Louisiana to move forward.
Jason in Baton Rouge. Jason, you're on Talk Louisiana with Dr. Wilson.
Hey, good morning, Dr. Wilson and Jim. I just had a quick comment about the work zone, the highway work zones. So even though that was an extraordinary incident in Baltimore, just every day in a work zone for a highway worker, our contractor can be dangerous, and many are killed across the nation each year, and in Louisiana, too. So it's always a place where safety is, you know, very paramount. Thank you.
Well, Jason, thank you for that comment. You know, safety has to be job one. That is a culture that we need to hold in the highest regard, and I'm very proud of the record of safety that we had at the department. While we did lose employees, those were the five hardest days of my career. And Department of Transportation is calling a loved one to say that they aren't coming home for working. And I've been quoted as saying, you know, the office and the water cooler area for a construction worker is loaded with cars driving much faster than they should, texting on their phones, all kinds of distractions. And losing one life is one too many, which is why we did things like buy attenuators and put our people in uniforms and change our processes to ensure that they're safe and tried to pass laws and policies that would protect us and slow people down, because speed and lack of control is what kills people. And construction workers, there's a monument at the Department of Transportation honoring the people who've lost their lives. And I appreciate you pointing that out for the listeners, because we take them for granted. Mm-hmm. And if it weren't for those construction workers on that bridge, think about the number of cars that could have been on that bridge any hour of the day that would have been a part of that collapse. It's amazing that more people weren't killed. And so I'm grateful for them. That was the nugget of the story that stood out for me the most, was after that May Day, less than a minute and a half, those construction workers stopped what they were doing and started to deter traffic, as well as the law enforcement that heard that. So I commend those individuals. They're heroes in my book.
A listener, Tracy in Baton Rouge, asked about a couple of bills that are unrelated to this tragedy, but is the former Secretary of Transportation. One would do away with mandatory helmets for motorcycle riders. It already cleared the House. 60-43 was a vote in the lower chamber, now being debated in the Senate. And the other, no use of cell phones while driving. Your thoughts about those potential laws that could be part of the fabric of Louisiana?
Well, look, I've gone on the record of supporting the hands-free bill. We attempted to pass that bill on many occasions, but were not successful. I think it's a good policy. Under my tenure, we did pass a bill to make hands-free zones in school districts with a higher fine. And so that is a good step in the right direction. With regards to this policy on helmets, I mean, it's an accident waiting to happen. It's a death waiting to happen. We know the cost of those types of accidents involving cyclists. And think about the lives that have been saved with seatbelts. Think about the lives that have been saved with helmets. We talk about that for children with bicycles. We want people to be flexible and independent. But on one hand, you can't talk about lowering insurance rates and then turn around and pass that kind of asinine policy that's going to take helmets off of people and just put them in harm's way. It does not make sense, and we resisted that during my tenure, and it would be my hope that the legislature pushes back on that because, again, we will be an outlier. We're already an outlier. We kill 2.5 people per day every day of the year on the roads of Louisiana, and that's far too many. And when you have the motorcyclists and the types of 18-wheelers and large vehicles and distracted drivers you have, it just does not make sense to put people and to put our systems in such a crisis mode when that bill could potentially pass.
James in Metairie, you're on the air with Dr. Sean Wilson.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Dr. Wilson. In disgusting displays of right-wing, dumbed-down scapegoating, Republicans all over the country are using the Key Bridge tragedy to justify their racism and homophobia, blaming it on a gay guy, Pete Buttigieg, blaming it on diversity, equity, and inclusion for the black mayor and board in the Baltimore area. Sir, had you been the Department of Transportation secretary under Joe Biden, they'd be blaming you.
Well, look, folks will scapegoat all kinds of ways. And when you look at facts, and we have to get back in society to dealing with facts and not just perceptions and political stories, none of those things that people are accusing the secretary or the construction workers or the mayors have any merit when it comes to lives lost, infrastructure impacted, and the rebuilding of that. And so clearly we need to focus on what really matters. And I would implore all of our constituents, Republican, Democrats, and independents alike, look at the facts. Let's stop making policy decisions on perceptions and look at data. The ship did not work. It hit the bridge's main span. There was no conspiracy around who did it. There's no conspiracy around what the secretary did. He has done what every secretary of transportation would have done, which was lean forward and use the power of that position and all the resources to get commerce back intact, because that is how you grow and maintain an economy. And you have to do that in a way that protects lives. So I applaud the secretary. He has done a phenomenal job under such difficult circumstances that have nothing to do with transportation and infrastructure sometimes.
Well, even as a seasoned and expert on construction and bridges, it was astonishing to watch that bridge fall. It was unbelievable to see that.
The video was no different. You know, the same feeling I got in September 11th watching the Twin Towers collapse. Those types of things, that will forever be emblazoned in people's minds as they watch that for the first time. It was much swifter than any planned demolition that I've ever seen. But it was a critical piece of infrastructure and a critical element of that bridge that was taken out instantly when that vessel impacted it. And there's going to have to be some accountability for what happened. The part of the Highway Transportation Safety Board, Jennifer Homendy, is going to do a phenomenal job, I believe, in her investigation to understand what happened. They're going to be very thorough. They're going to recreate this thing and understand what happened and then apply technology and innovation to prevent it from happening again, not just in Baltimore, but everywhere. Every accident you see, Jim, that happens, the industry, if we're doing it right, and I believe we are, we're going to improve all across our country with the lessons that we learn in that process. That is what being a professional transportation director or advisor is about.
Thank you, Sean Wilson. Always a pleasure. Congrats on your new job. We'll be back next week. Stay tuned.